Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, this is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Friday, March the 4th. As we like to do from time to time, we'll be chatting with our friend Barry Castleman, the Prairie Editor, up in the Twin Cities. And we'll be talking primarily tonight about the U.S. Senate races. There are some very fascinating races. I think there's two that I've been following closely, the one in Georgia and the one in Arizona. But, of course, Barry has been following more of them. And will give us some updates tonight. So let me say hello to our friend Barry. How's the weather up in Minneapolis?
It's actually very nice. We seem to be past the worst of the winter, although you've got to be very careful. You never know what kind of Arctic blast we'll get.
Yeah, one of my memories from having lived in Wisconsin was it was starting to feel like spring. You know, with the baseball season coming up and, you know, you were kind of getting into the spring feeling. And opening day, which was on a Friday, was canceled because of an ice storm. So you just never know up there, you know, when winter is going to have one last act.
Yes.
And so, yeah, you're right. I mean, you just have to, you hope for spring, but you know that winter always has a little surprise for you. Well, let's talk a little bit about the U.S. Senate seats tonight. But before we get there, I wanted to ask you about the general situation with President Biden, because it seems like nothing works. Nothing seems to work. Whatever they do, whatever reset or whatever they want to call it, whatever they do, Barry, just doesn't work. I mean, his numbers continue to be at 40%. Some are down to 37%. You now have a situation, for example, here in Texas, where the Democrat running for governor does not want President Biden in Texas. Several other Democrats here in Texas, and I think in other states too. So how does President Biden put it back together, Barry?
Well, one thing he's not been doing, he's never changed his course back to being the moderate that he ran as. So everything he's doing is the will of the far left or the more radical left of his party. And these are very unacceptable. That's on the policy side. Number two, he's very old, even though 79 is not the oldest age you could be. But the fact of the matter is that he's not as sharp as he used to be. He seems to be being mostly managed by his staff. And he never was a man of particular ideas or policies. And that's showing up too. The fact is that he's on, I think a conservative would say he's on the wrong side of history.
Mm-hmm.
But even a Democrat, a moderate liberal, would say he's not on the wrong side of history, but he's not being true to himself.
Yeah.
Or to what he ran as.
Right.
So he keeps making mistakes. One after another, and then the situation. Some are his own doing, and some are not. I mean, the border crisis is his doing. Ukraine, perhaps, is his doing. Russia, China. foreign policy things are pretty much givens that he has to deal with, but he isn't originating them.
Mm-hmm.
Energy policy is his doing.
Mm, that's right.
You know, if you don't allow pipelines and fracking and other things, where we were actually no longer oil dependent, we're back to being oil dependent now. And those are his doing. Those are mistakes. Those are not popular.
Mm-hmm.
He's not doing things which the public, the voting public, like.
Right. Well, I can tell you the price of gasoline is killing the family budget. A few days ago, I filled up my car, and I have a small car, 12-gallon car, four-cylinder, $3.45. That's what I paid a gallon. I drove by the station today, same station, 3 days later, the price is $3.59, so it's going up 10 cents in 3 days, roughly. And, you know, I drive around town, and it's, you know, the prices where I live are consistent with other places. And I think just the price of gasoline is enough, I think, to anger the country significantly. But I wanted to remind the audience that you had an opportunity to meet Joe Biden, I think back in the 80s, right? And you wrote an editorial back then predicting that he would be president of the United States. Obviously, he was a much younger man and a different person back then. But what puzzles me about Joe Biden more than anything else, Barry, is how he's allowed himself to become captive of the left. It's like any politician with any common sense running as he did as a moderate, following a president like President Trump, who was very loud and, you know, he was a good president, but he had his defects, that it just seems to me that President Biden would have told, you know, the left-wing base, the immigration activist, the climate change activist, he would have told them, people, you need to slow down. I cannot do all those things for you because I've got bigger problems. I got to be a moderate, but also I got to worry about COVID. But somewhere along the line, he lost all of that, Barry, and it really surprises me. Does it surprise you?
He's not alone. Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are also moderates, and they've been kowtowing to the left as well, mainly because out of fear, because the left actually threatens, because if there's a division, a schism in the party, that is going to help Republicans. And that's exactly what's happening. Now, the Republicans have their own divisions, but they're not as serious, at least up till now, as the ones that divide the Democratic Party. I think the majority of Democrats are liberals. They're left of center. They have liberal ideas. And it's the way it's always been. But there's a small...
Yeah.
But sizable or loud minority, which call for more radical ideas, which are completely like defund the police.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or certain environmental questions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's so many issues. The border crisis, that was his own doing. He created the crisis.
Absolutely.
During the campaign.
Absolutely.
Promising to open the border, so people came up.
Absolutely.
To get inside, and then he let them inside.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Well, speaking of the fear that Democrats have of the left, one Democrat, Henry Cuellar, down here in South Texas, has been forced into a runoff with a young woman named Jessica Cisneros, who is an AOC-type Democrat. And everybody's in shock. Nobody expected that to happen. But, you know, in these primaries, well, you don't have a big turnout to begin with. If you organize yourself, you can pull off an upset like AOC herself pulled off in New York and a couple of others that we've seen in the Democrat primaries in the last couple of years. So the one thing that the AOC-type Democrats, the one thing they can do is get organized in these primaries, Barry.
Yes, and it's the Achilles heel of the Democratic Party. And Biden is not strong enough, I think, emotionally, at this point in his life, to resist and give them what they want, and his numbers go down and down.
Yeah.
Because what they want is not what the public wants, and I mean not Republicans, just the general public.
Right. I agree with you. I think most Democrats are left-center, but that's not the way he's been governing. He has not been governing left-center. He's been governing as if Bernie Sanders was elected president.
Well,
and Bernie Sanders couldn't even get the nomination because he was too far to the left, Barry.
That's right.
So, no, I think it's the most amazing thing I've ever seen. You know, I've followed every president going back to a little bit of LBJ, certainly Richard Nixon, and every president since. And they've had their problems, you know, along the way. But I've never seen a president basically just surrender himself to a wing of the party. I don't remember any.
Who's the woman senator from Massachusetts?
Senator Warren, you mean?
Yeah. So Senator Warren and Bernie Sanders never couldn't win a presidential election. They couldn't even win very many primaries. And yet they seem to be in charge. And they're ilk.
No,
but
you're
this
right.
Is not,
that's
this
it.
Is not, this is not a winning ticket.
No.
And they're running out of time. You know, I've said this on your program before, and I've written it. You know, we're 8 months from the election. That seems like a long time. People say it's a lifetime. But it's not. Because you can't really reverse your field. The fact of the matter is that all these House and Senate candidates are on the record, on videotape, and on recordings, stating their support for the more radical agenda. Now, many of them have changed reverse field. We have at least one vulnerable congresswoman up here who has reversed fields 180 degrees on defunding the police. But she was very outspoken, and her opponent has her on tape saying the opposite of what she says now. So what are you going to believe?
Right.
Is it just political rhetoric, or does she mean it? And you need to be able to, if you're going to change your mind, you need to be able to do it well in advance to get people used to your viewpoint.
Mm-hmm.
If you do it the last minute, people think it's just gobbledygook.
Right. No, I think you're right, and the other problem that I think the president has, and you touched on it before, is that he doesn't come across very well, partially because he comes across as an older man who doesn't seem to have the energy to be president. You know, he does most of his press conferences are done in the afternoon, which is not the way most other presidents have done them. And the State of the Union, I had a chance to listen to it. I listened to the rerun. I didn't listen to it live. But the first part about Ukraine, I don't have a problem with it. I think he said, you know, he was about, on the Ukraine part, he was fine. But it's when he got to the domestic politics where you just kept, you know, asking yourself, am I watching The Twilight Zone? Because it just didn't make any sense, Barry. I don't think you had a chance to see it. I think you mentioned to me that you didn't have a chance to see it, which is okay. But, I mean, I did watch the rerun of it, and the Ukraine part was okay, but the rest of the speech I thought was a disaster, Barry.
Well, he's not exactly – you know, when I first met him, he was an outstanding public speaker, very eloquent and very riveting in the 80s. That's no longer true. And I've said this on your program since I knew him reasonably well then. He does not appear to be very much the same person he was. I mean, he is the same person, but he doesn't seem to have the vitality that he had when, which is typical of most people. I mean, we are electing people here in their late 70s.
Right, right.
And well, that, by the way, leads us into a point I want to make about the Senate.
Yes, but may I just say something just to follow up on that real quickly, and we'll get into the Senate in a minute. But I have gone back and I've watched videos of Joe Biden, like when he ran for president in '88, when he was a very active senator in the '90s, and even as far as 2008 when he ran for president. It is amazing to watch him. To watch those videos and see him now. I mean, it was like you say, all the energy's gone. But anyway, let's talk about the Senate, because that's our main topic tonight. So go ahead, take it away.
Well, I just wrote a piece, a freelance piece, that appears in the AMAC Newsline, in which I discuss a new development in the Senate races. First of all, at the outset of the campaign several months ago, it was generally acknowledged there were four truly vulnerable Democrats and four truly vulnerable Republican seats, some of which were open seats because the incumbent retired. In a fairly dramatic occurrence in the last few months, even the very liberal pundits and pollsters have basically said the four vulnerable Republicans are no longer very vulnerable, but the four Democrats are. But one of my points is, as Biden's numbers remain very low and his policies are unpopular, it's going to start to drag down so-called safe seats. And I illustrate it with the latest development in the state of Vermont. The president pro tem of the Senate, Patrick Leahy, is 81, and he announced his retirement. And immediately the sole Democratic congressman, the only congressman the state has, Peter Welch, announced he would run. And, of course, everyone said, well, that's that. Vermont is a very blue state. Peter Welch is known by everybody. He's already run statewide. The race is over. Not so fast. A 42-year-old former U.S. attorney, confirmed unanimously by the U.S. Senate, Christina Nolan, announced her candidacy, a very bright and attractive and first-ranked candidate. Peter Welch is 74, almost 75, running for the Senate for the first time. Biden, who carried the state by 30 points in 2020, has taken a nosedive, as he has throughout New England, New Hampshire, Vermont, Maine. He's not doing well. In fact, he's behind in Maine. So here you have a young, vital, attractive candidate, a woman who's 42, running against a 75-year-old or 74-year-old man. And what is the key to the Senate? The key is seniority, being there for a while and being on good committees and having the ability to get things for your state. The prospects are now that the Republicans will take the Senate back. So Peter Welch, even if he were elected, and even if he were 74 or 5 years old, which he will be, would have no influence in the Senate for the first several years, if at all. Whereas Christina Nolan could be one of the bright young figures. Now, she's a Susan Collins-type senator. That is to say, a moderate. She's probably, I don't know this for a fact, but most New England Republicans are pro-choice. And on a couple of hot-button issues, she's not where most Republicans are. But as I point out, you need her vote to elect the leader and to pass, to block the more radical legislation, which she would also oppose, as Susan Collins opposes. You know, we have a lot of purists in both parties today, like the AOC types on the left and some other Republicans on the right. They won't tolerate anyone who doesn't agree with them completely. Well, this is not very good politics. This is no way to run a country and no way to run a Congress. And my point is that it's twofold. One, that you're going to have a small group of moderate Republicans, just like you have Joe Manchin and Ms. Senator Sistema in Arizona, who are moderate Democrats. Your party has to have room for them because you can't conduct the business of the Senate or the House if you don't have a majority.
Right.
But I also, my second point is that Biden can't be in the low high 30s or even the low 40s when we get to Election Day. If he does, you're going to have not only a red wave, you're going to have a tidal wave.
Mm-hmm.
50 to 100 seats in the House, maybe 5 or 6 or 7 seats in the Senate.
Wow.
That's not what's likely now. I'm not saying that. I even said in my article that Peter Welch is still the clear favorite.
Mm-hmm.
But that could disappear. That advantage could disappear very quickly.
Right. That's exactly right. Yeah, because if you have these waves, they tend to, like a tsunami, and it just rolls everything over.
Well, you communicate to the public, if you're on the winning side, mm-hmm. you say, the only way you can protest these policies which you oppose is to vote against their party,
mm-hmm.
no matter who the candidate is.
Right.
And that's why, for example, Chuck Schumer, a lot of people are very confused why Chuck Schumer has been shifting so far to the left. But AOC and her group have said they're thinking about challenging him in the primary. And what happens in New York is you have multi-party ballots. And it doesn't take very much maneuvering in New York in a primary to defeat an incumbent, even someone as well-known
right.
and solid-seeming as Chuck Schumer. And so he's worried. And that sort of political blackmail, if you will, is what's hurting the Democratic Party across the country.
Right. Let me take a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll continue unless you want to make a quick point, and then we take a break, whichever one you like.
Well, I just want to make the point.
Yeah, go ahead.
That the Biden weakness, if it continues, leads to the nationalization of the election and a disaster for the Democrats.
Right. Yeah, it's happened in 94 with Clinton and 2010 with Obama, and I guess to some extent with Bush in 2006. Let's take a little break, and we'll be back with our friend Barry Castleman right after this. The music of my good friend Carlos Gevis, who is from Venezuela and plays around the Dallas area. We have a link to his website on the show information. Well, Barry, let's get back to the Senate. You were talking about Vermont, and you were talking about the nationalization of the election. We've seen that before. 1980, for example, when there was a national wave against President Carter, and I'm sure you've seen others. Tell me, go through some of the races that you think could be important on election day as you see it right now. And I know we have 8 months ahead, and in some cases we don't even have candidates, like in Pennsylvania and Ohio. We're still waiting for a candidate. But nevertheless, give me your sense of where we are with respect to the Senate. You've told us about Vermont. What are some of the others, Barry?
Well, they are obvious ones. So you have Wisconsin. You have Arizona. You have Nevada. And the fourth one was Florida. Florida, I think, is over with. I think Marco Rubio is going to win easily. In fact, all four look like winners. And only a month or so ago, they looked very, very iffy that they could win. On the other hand, the Democrats are really at risk of losing four seats. Arizona, Nevada, Georgia. Oh, Georgia's another seat, a Republican seat that was iffy. But you have, and you have, of course, Georgia, and you have, those are the seats where the Democrats are in real trouble, and they shouldn't necessarily be that way, but unless they can find a way to separate themselves from President Biden, the red wave is going to knock them out.
Right. And that's what happens with these waves. As I said, you know, we've seen some of these waves before. Now, you didn't mention New Hampshire. There's an incumbent Democrat in New Hampshire.
Right, I meant to.
Yeah, please.
So New Hampshire is Maggie Hassan, and her opponent has not been determined.
Mm-hmm.
But she is in very serious trouble because her numbers are in the low 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, as we discussed in the discussion of 2021, the governors of Virginia and New Jersey were not high in the poll numbers, even though, for example, in New Jersey, everybody knew at the end it was going to be close in Virginia. But no, everybody was caught surprised. And I said on this program, no, the governor of New Jersey's in trouble because he's only at 50.
Mm-hmm.
In the polling just before the election. And the numbers an incumbent gets is really the number you're gonna get. And your opponent's going to pick up most of the undecided. And that's what's the problem for many incumbents. Like Hassan, she's not very popular to begin with. And this year promises to be a year in which if you can't energize, you know, I think you made a point when we were discussing before the program, the turnout
mm-hmm.
of Republicans in Texas, for example, was very strong, but the turnout of the Democrats was lackluster. This is something which is actually happening nationwide, which is understandable. The Republicans are aroused, and they're motivated to go to the polls, and the Democrats are demoralized.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They don't. The leadership of their party is not strong. They're confused about what the policies of the party are.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them are very unhappy. You saw, as I mentioned, the congresswoman from Minnesota, who was very much for defunding the police, suddenly realized it was a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
So she did a 180.
Right.
But it's very hard to do that and be credible.
That, well, that's right. Even President Biden during the State of the Union said he was against defunding the police. The mere fact that a president would have to say that shows you that he's got problems, because I've never heard a president of the United States on any speech having to say that he's against defunding the police. So the fact that President Biden had to say it simply confirms that there's a weakness for the party. Now, something about New Hampshire fascinates me, because that's supposed to be a pretty conservative state, and here they have a liberal Democrat. How did that happen, Barry?
Well, New Hampshire. So one of the points I make in my article that I mentioned is that the New England states have a habit of electing moderate Republicans. Even Leahy himself was elected as a Republican. He changed parties. And even the other senators, Angus King, and Angus King is an independent who caucuses with the Democrats, but is a relatively moderate figure. So one of the things that happens in a place like New Hampshire. Now, in Maine, President Biden is actually underwater, because in addition to his unpopularity, he did a presidential act which has restricted lobster fishing off the coast of Maine. Well, that's, you can't be against lobster fishing in Maine.
That's part of their main industries, right?
So what you have is, the president has a tin ear.
Mm-hmm.
He's pushing for restrictions and presidential actions, which don't even, I mean, the idea that you would not have pipelines,
mm-hmm.
and that you would do in the coal and oil and gas industries in a complete way. I mean, it made no sense. He antagonized his own base, Republicans.
Well, sure, the labor unions, right? Because many of those jobs are union jobs, right?
Yeah. And the blue-collar voters are now very much divided.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the union leadership is still strongly Democratic, but not the rank and file. And we saw that in Minnesota, where up in the 8th District, which was a traditionally 2-to-1 Democratic district, the Republicans now have a big majority. And a lot of their majority comes from union members and working class people who no longer share the extreme views of many Democrats.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that here in Texas, the Hispanic vote, which is a very reliable Democrat vote, particularly in South Texas, has been shifting to the Republicans. And the issues are the border, defunding the police, the attacks on the Border Patrol and the police, because a very high percentage of our Border Patrol people and police are Hispanics. So, you know, they feel like, you know, why is the party attacking my brother, my son, my husband, who works in the Border Patrol? So the Democrats, there seems to be, when I look at them, it seems like the party is going out of its way to alienate the working people, the blue-collar people, the people who go to church, the people who have traditional values. They seem to be going out of their way to attack those people. Makes no political sense, Barry, but that's what they're doing.
Right. Well, and also, I think Democrats, Republicans thought they would do a little better with redistricting,
mm-hmm.
and reapportionment. They did a little bit better, not quite as much. But it doesn't make any difference. You have districts which they made a little stronger for Democrats. But if there's a wave, it won't make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Right. If there's
a...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Risk, and we haven't talked about the house.
Yes.
But there's a chance of a great number of pickups. The numbers vary. I think the lowest number is around 15 net gain for the Democrats, for the Republicans. But I think it's more like 30 or 40.
Mm-hmm.
And if the president's numbers don't improve, it will be more like 50 or 60.
Well, if you remember 66, 64, that's what it was under President Clinton in 94 and President Obama in 2010. But I feel pretty confident about the House. The Senate, of course, is not that I'm not confident, but that's always a little bit more difficult. But listening to you tonight, you feel very comfortable that at least where things are today, that the Republicans could pick up four or five seats and end up with maybe 54 seats in the Senate. And that would have a tremendous impact on appointments to judges, even if there is a Supreme Court nomination down the road, Barry.
Well, yes. Now, I'm not making any specific numbers, predictions. That would be very, very more than speculative. But I can see a clear net gain in the Senate and a substantial gain in the House. I think the Democrats sort of have already basically thrown in the towel. I noticed that several of my pundit colleagues, some of whom lean more to the left than I do, have also thrown in the towel and are now conceding that it's starting to look very good for the Republicans.
Mm-hmm. Now,
the issues lie ahead. The stock market is wavering.
Mm-hmm.
We have inflation. We have a border crisis. I'm not even going to talk about international affairs,
right,
which isn't as easy to control, and in which presidents, no matter who they are, sometimes get into trouble. But the domestic policy, I mean, we've gone from under President Trump being energy independent and being a net exporter of gas and oil back to being dependent again.
Right. No, that's an amazing amazing setback. Now, what do you make of polling data, Barry, that says over 50% majority, healthy majorities of the American people think that, and two different polls that came out saying the same thing, like 55, 57% of Americans feel that Putin would not have invaded Ukraine if President Trump was in the White House. I mean, it's pure speculation, obviously, you know, because...
I don't know what I can... Those are poll numbers.
Right.
They don't necessarily reflect reality.
Right.
I think...
But I do think, Barry, they reflect dissatisfaction with Biden. I don't think it's much about Trump. I don't think that it's really about Trump. I think it's more about Biden.
Yes. I think they feel that he has been unable to stabilize our relationships in the Far East, the Middle East, and in Europe. I mean, we have problems in all those places. We still haven't worked anything out with Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And our strong relationship with the Abraham Accord countries that was established is weak, has been weakened. China remains a puzzle and a long-term challenge. One thing your polling does tell us is the public doesn't have a lot of confidence
mm-hmm.
in the president and his administration.
That's right. You know, sometimes for those of us who remember the late 70s, in the late 70s, it was more than inflation and high gas prices. In the late 70s, it was also a sense that countries all over the, you know, our enemies were sort of running all over the United States, whether it was the Soviets, whether it was Central America, whether it was in the Far East. It just seemed like back the United States was playing defense for much of the late 70s. And you kind of get the same feeling now, Barry.
Well, I think there's a lot of people who feel that way. And I think that, again, this becomes part of the overall picture of the midterm elections that are only now less than 8 months away.
Mm-hmm. That's right, 8 months away. Well, just one...
By the way...
Yeah, go ahead.
I don't know if you know this. It's a little-known fact. Not a big deal. But today is the only day of the year which is a command.
March 4th, right?
The only way it's a command.
Right. Yes. I saw that this afternoon. I was looking at one of my emails, and somebody sent out something about March 4th. Yes, I agree. well, that's a good way to wrap it up, Barry, but it gives us enough material to do it again. One quick question, Barry, before we go. How do you see Texas? I feel very confident down here, but how does it look from up there?
Well, I really defer to you. I think Texas, I saw the latest poll numbers, which show the governor and in a very strong position, and Mr. O'Rourke not doing very well.
Right.
I have to believe that at least one or two of the Democratic congressmen in the South are going to, if not lose, have a very narrow escape in the polls, because I don't think the people who live where you are, not only in Texas, but in New Mexico, Colorado, Nevada, I don't think there are people feeling very good about the way the border crisis is being
handled. No, I think you're exactly right about that. Now, to be fair, I'm 500 miles away from the border, but it's still, I mean, there's a sense here in Texas that everybody, that we're all border states, because the problems are, and like you say, it was all self-inflicted. He didn't have to do any of this. He could have told the immigration activists back when he took over, first week on the job, he could have told the immigration activists, folks, I cannot do this right now, not in the middle of a pandemic. We got to shut it down and keep it the way Trump was running it. Trump had done a pretty good job on the border, actually, and he could have kept it that way. But, again, he couldn't say no to the border activists, whether it's the climate change activists or the border activists. And they've pushed him in a direction, as you indicated, Barry, unpopular direction, and he's paying the price. Barry, I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight and for giving us your viewpoints, and we got to do it again. And I'm just hoping the next time we get together that they're playing baseball, because it doesn't look like they're going to be playing baseball anytime soon. The owners and the players are caught up in negotiations that are getting uglier by the day. So I just hope that when we talk in 30 days or so that they're playing baseball, because I miss it, and I'm sure you do too.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Barry. Barry Castleman, the Prairie Editor. We have a link to his website, and always recommend it very, very much when we talk to people. Thank you, Barry. Have a wonderful evening. Well, thank you for listening. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, South Texas. Always enjoy chatting with our friend Barry Castleman, the Prairie Editor. As I said, we have a link to Barry's website on the show information. Always recommend that you check it out. Have a wonderful evening, everybody.